This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
Hi, I am Brooke Spector, your host, and my guest today, my second guest today, actually, because we're splitting the discussion. First was on foreign policy, its temptations and challenges. And today, in the second half, we're going to talk about economics and government economic business needs, also the landscape, the temptations and the challenges. And we're really pleased to have somebody I've heard in many different circumstances take really complicated economic issues and make them really simple and understandable and crystalline clear. This is, of course, Davi Root, chief economist and director of the Efficient Group. And he's had a career for decades, including almost a decade as an economist with the South African Reserve Bank, an economic editor. He lectures at Gibbs, and he's all over the place in commentary and analysis in other media. And every time I hear him, I go, yeah, okay, now I understand it better, even without the charts. And of course, because this is radio, we can't see any charts. So we're going to have to do it with word pictures. And here we are in a moment just before the country finds out what the shape of its new government is going to be, who's going to be in it, and what policies will be ascendant, and what the infighting will look like, let alone who the key figures are going to be over the next little while of appointments and sharp elbowed back and forth. But having said that, the economic and political challenges will be there regardless of who's in charge, almost regardless of which party is in charge. And that's what I want to talk with you about, because you're the man who can help explain this to us. And so the key question for you is, what are the key economic challenges for this country and the incoming government? Go ahead. You have a minute and a half to explain it all.
Thank you very much, and good morning to you. Yeah, key challenges. A minute is certainly not enough to explain all the key challenges, but I would broadly, trying to look at it from a political perspective, I would broadly categorize the key challenges in three major challenges. The first one is local authorities. The local authorities in South Africa are a mess. We need to fix that. And the majority, and I can give you some numbers if you're interested in, but the local authorities is a major challenge. A second major challenge has to do with the state-owned enterprises. That's Eskom and Transnet and just about all of them. They are financially and operationally been run into the ground pretty much. And the third one has to do with the stuff that the Minister of Finance is responsible for. That is state debt. That has to do with state spending and taxes and stuff like that. Now, that is particularly important because we're going to have some sort of coalition government now. And of course, that is what politics and when you talk about politics, that is what politics is about. That is what the democracy is about. It is about where are you going to get taxes, where you're going to get money, and where you're going to spend the money. Of course, there are many other challenges, but those are the three major ones. The local authorities, state-owned enterprises, and the national accounts and what's going on there. And in all three cases, we are in very deep trouble. The local authorities are a mess. State-owned enterprises are a mess. And we are heading for a crisis when it comes to the national accounts, the accounts of the Minister of Finance. So I would say those are the three major challenges. Of course, there are many other things. We need to get the economy to grow. We have to improve efficiency. We have to do something about labor policy. And the list goes on and the list goes on. But I would say those are the three major challenges.
I was joking when I said you had a minute and a half, but you really did pretty well do that within about 2 minutes. I'm astonished. One of the things you didn't mention, and you have been quoted about this. You wrote you were the prime source for an article, or I guess you actually wrote it the other day on what the country doesn't need, which is a very large, expensive, not particularly well organized, managed, and guided national health insurance scheme. And you were saying there are very different other mechanisms and ways to deal with this to improve the quality of health.
Again, we have to look at it in the current political environment. Now, the minister, or rather the president, signed that into law, the NHI, just before the election. And obviously, that was just a cheap political stunt by the president, trying to get more people to vote for the ANC. That actually blew up in their faces, because I don't think people were really convinced that we're going to get an NHI. But I don't think we're going to see an NHI. I don't think the NHI is going to become a reality for a very, very long time. And there are basically, well, a couple of reasons, but the very obvious reason is simply that we do not have enough money, that the economy is overtaxed. The economy is just not growing fast enough to provide enough resources for more spending, let alone a huge increase in spending in the form of the NHI. So there simply isn't money, as simple as that, and there's no way to get money. A second reason has to do with the legal issues. I think the state is going to be bogged down and it's all sort of legal challenges for a very, very long time. I've spoken to some of my legal eagle friends, and they tell me it's probably unconstitutional as it stands at the moment. So I don't think that's going to become a reality. I think legal issues will prevent that from happening for a long time. And the third reason is that it's one thing good about having a mostly an incompetent government is they can also not implement a bad idea. So that's a third reason why I think it's not.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing at that.
I've got my own suggestions on how we should be doing this. For example, I think that we can actually privatize it. And if you want to talk about that, I can tell you what I think. But I think it's actually quite possible to privatize the whole thing and actually do everything much, much cheaper and get a much better service, especially for the poor people in the country. But that's another discussion, I guess.
Yeah, no, we'll come back to that in the moment NHI becomes a discussion topic in specific terms. I'd simply add that every doctor I've talked to, as I get older, I talk to more and more doctors because there are more and more pieces of me that need help. Every one of them has had some version of what you've just said. And the younger ones, black and white, male and female, have looked at me and said, if it actually happens the way the government's planning it, they may look at Vancouver as a new residence or some other version of things. And that some of that's just words, but even so, it is a little frightening. Let me move away from NHI slightly, specifically, to the question of growing the economy, which you alluded to right at the outset. But what isn't clear, what is the mechanism to do that? I mean, is it simply saying to the government, get out of the way? Is it saying, here's lots of cash, enjoy yourselves? Yeah. I mean, there have to be serious mechanisms.
Okay, I think, before we get to how to grow the economy, I think it's important to understand what those magic ingredients is to get an economy to grow. And once you know what those magic ingredients are, then you have to look at your policies and you have to look at your laws to see if any of those laws or policies are standing in the way of those magic ingredients, and then remove them. It's very simple. So what are those three? And I've got three magic ingredients that will guarantee economic growth. And I use this word, guarantee economic growth. Now, the three magic ingredients are, first of all, you must protect private property rights. I'm going to go through them quickly and we're going to come back to them. You must protect private property rights, firstly. Secondly, what you need to do, you must allow for free trade. And the third thing that you need to do, you must have sound money. Now, what does sound money mean? Sound money simply means that inflation must be low. And it's important for inflation to be low because and we can discuss that a little bit. Low inflation means that high inflation simply means that it distorts prices in the economy, and distorting prices makes it very difficult to allocate resources. So if you want to talk about that, we can talk about that a little bit more. But coming back to the first two, the second one about free trade is crucially important because there's a saying in economics, and that saying is there is no free lunch. But I'm afraid there is one free lunch, and this free lunch is free trade. Because think a little bit about this. If there is free trade, then both the buyer and the seller gains from this transaction. Think about that. So both are better off after the transaction. And that means you created wealth out of free trade. There's a free lunch. Can you believe that? But you cannot have free trade if you don't own something to trade. And that's why the protection of private property rights is so important. So if you protect private property rights and you allow people to trade freely and you have sound money, then you create free lunches out of nothing. Literally, you create all these extra wealth out of nothing. Now, if you look at it like that, then it's quite easy to pinpoint the policy deficits that we have in South Africa and the wrong policies that we have in South Africa. Now, let's just start with private property rights. We have this expropriation nonsense of the ANC government. That undermines private property rights. We have very high levels of taxes in South Africa. That is a way of undermining private property rights. And the list goes on and the list goes on. So those are the changes we need to make. Also, if you look at trade.
I have to take a break here. We have to do station identifications and advertisements and those kinds of things. It's radio. We got there are no free lunches in radio either. Even though I've read my David Ricardo and Alexander Hamilton too, we still have to do these things. So,
this is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
Deep Dive, and guest today, the second guest, as we're looking at the government that's coming into power and the challenges and temptations for that government. First half of our discussion today was on foreign policy. But the second half, of course, is now the economics of the country and the economics for the government, which I guess is, since we're all associated with the government one way or another, we pay our taxes, we're influenced by what they do. This is, I guess, particularly crucial. And who better than Dawie Root, economist? And I interrupted you with that station break just before you were going to dive deeper into some of the requisites in what you were saying. Go ahead, pick up where you left off.
Yeah, the magic ingredients, protection of private property rights, free trade, and sound money. So let's unpack that a little bit. Now, we know there are many obstacles to that, policy issues and legislation, all sort of things threatening private property rights and not protecting private property rights. Let me just expand a little bit on that. I did mention the expropriation bill as an example, excessive taxes, for example, but private property rights, I really mean a very, very broad definition thereof. Things like, for example, my life, for example, is my property as well. And if my life is not protected, that is actually undermining private property rights. For example, if you take my life, you steal my life, we call it murder. So that I even include a safe environment, a very broad definition of private property rights protection. And we can see that the ANC's official policies and what happens in practice undermines private property rights. The second one is free trade. And there are many examples of how free trade, where you create free lunches, how free trade is undermined. Things like, for example, private property rights undermining, that's part of the thing undermining free trade as well. But there are obstacles to free trade. Minimum wages is an obstacle to free trade. People that wants to buy and sell labor are prevented from doing that, prevent them from creating a free lunch. Because there's minimum wages. You're throwing sand in the machine. Import duties of all sorts are nothing but throwing sands in it. So it's all sort of protection and preventing people from trade, all those sort of things, preventing people from creating free lunches. And there are many examples how there are policy clashes between the various political parties when it comes to trade. The third one has to do with sound money. And again, there are many examples of that. We know, for example, certain political parties want to nationalize the Reserve Bank. The nationalization of the Reserve Bank is not necessarily a problem. But what they want to do is that they want to get the Reserve Bank to start acting irresponsibly when it comes to inflation. That is actually what they are trying to achieve here. While some other political parties, I know, for example, the DA, that was one of the requirements on Government of National Unity, is that the Reserve Bank will not the Reserve Bank will be left and the independence of the Reserve Bank will be guaranteed. So again, you can see the policy clashes and the various political ideologies and how the various policies, how that undermine and how the different political parties actually differ on that. And we can see that in the negotiations where the various political parties are talking to one another now. The one bunch want to nationalize everything. They want to nationalize the banks and all property. The other lot say, no, 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 we don't want to nationalize things. Some lot say that, listen, we want to kick out all foreigners. Other lot say, no, no, foreigners got a certain function, or they've got a role to play in South Africa. But basically, it comes down to those three things: private property rights protection, the freedom to trade, and of course, sound money.
Well, when you talk about free trade and the availability of a free lunch buffet as a result of free trade, I'm looking at that and I'm visualizing a large number of former textile workers and clothing workers who no longer have jobs because of the reduction of protective tariffs on textile imports. There is a balance to be maintained, I think, between some sort of protection of some industries in some cases at some point. And you're shaking your head. Listeners can't see you, but you're shaking your head. Explain to me why I'm wrong.
No, you're wrong. Because remember, the moment you protect an industry, yes, you protect an industry, you isolate this specific industry from foreign competition, and then that industry gets the opportunity to thrive and to be successful and to employ people. That is usually the story that we are told. But what we are not told is that the moment you protect an industry, you and I, the consumer, pays a price for that. That is nothing but a hidden tax the moment you protect an industry. And you can find, and I said free trade is crucially important, but there are many examples where you are actually prevented from trading. For example, in my industry, to be a financial advisor, you are not allowed to provide financial advice unless you are registered as a financial advisor. Many other examples. You are not allowed to practice law unless you are registered as a legal practitioner. I know what you're going to say. You say it's there to protect the public, but the public is paying for all of this. So you're preventing free trade from happening. And look at the specific industry that I can give you examples of in South Africa. Look at the motor car industry. The motor car industry in South Africa receives a massive tax, basically a subsidy from us, the consumers. And motor cars in South Africa cost double what it costs in many other countries in the world. And that's because you and I, we pay a subsidy to the local motor car industry and in order for them to survive, to protect them at the cost, and we're paying the price for that. Now, why can't we also protect other industries? Why don't we protect all the industries in the country? If we do that, we simply won't have enough taxes to pay all those subsidies, because that is what protection comes down to. It is a subsidy and it is a tax on the consumer. So no specific protection to industries. Even think about dumping. People talk about, you know, foreigners dump this stuff in South Africa and it's bad because it's bad for the local industry. But look at it differently. Dumping simply means that somebody else subsidizes your consumption. Isn't that the most amazing thing to happen? I want the whole of the rest of the world to come and dump stuff here. Don't you think I think it will be wonderful if my neighbor comes to me and dumps a lot of groceries in my backyard every day. That's the most amazing thing, because then I wouldn't have to buy it. I wouldn't have to work for that. So even dumping is one of those things that is not necessarily a bad thing. So no, you know, your default mode must always be for free trade. You can maybe, if you really twist my arm very, very hard, I may accept some kind of intervention sometimes. But the default mode must always be for total free trade and no protection.
I would note that the trend globally is protectionist.
Very much so. Yeah. More and more so.
The EU is imposing a serious tariff on Chinese electric-driven vehicles. American tariffs vis-a-vis China are increasing. I gather the Chinese are doing something similar. The impetus globally seems to be no more free lunches, no more dumped groceries, no more, you know, it's like you want free groceries, fine, pay double.
Yeah. Now, I'm afraid to say you're right. What we have experienced the past, say, 30 years or so is this thing that we call the global village, global integration of economies. and the world economy experienced the most amazing growth the last couple of decades. But for the past, say, 5 to 10 years or so, the reverse has been happening, is that more protection. It started with Trump, basically. And see what the result of that was. It's lower economic growth, but not only lower economic growth, tension between countries as well. And I will argue is that the conflict that we see in many places in the world, like, for example, Ukraine and the potential conflict in around Taiwan and many other ones, can indirectly be blamed on more protectionism. Because less protectionism means more integration, a more free flow of people and capital and goods. Everybody is working together and everybody is making money. We don't have time to fight one another. Protectionism means conflict by definition. It means conflict, and quite often it spills over into political conflict. And I would argue many of these political conflicts that we see globally has to do with economic protectionism, which is wrong.
Now, the ghost of John Maynard Keynes just walked into the studio, I think.
Tell him I say hi. And tell him von Mises is also saying hello.
Okay. We'll explain that to audiences next week. This is the Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up. Dawi has to go to other appointments on today, and we have to make way for the next program on this station. It's been a pleasure to have you on. We'll do this again. We'll take a whole hour, and we'll go through the whole range of economic issues. Once the new government is installed, their challenges, their temptations, and their policies, as well as the players who are involved in this. Again, thanks very much for your time. Today has been a double bill. Peter Fabricius first and Dawi Root second, not in that order, but just in that temporal sense. Again, take care. We'll talk to you next week. This is the Deep Dive. Spector, your host. Thank you again.